Broadcasting from a horse-drawn carriage rolling down State Street, it's the Funk Zone Podcast with your host, Ted Mills.
Why, hello, 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 folks. Welcome to the Funk Zone Podcast. This is episode 86. I'm your host, Ted Mills. Thank you for listening. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for walking in and just taking a weight off your feet. This is the show where I interview artists and creative people, and I try to find out why they do what they do. Today on the show, we have plein air painter Jeremy Harper. Jeremy is a part of the Oak Group, Santa Barbara's well-known plein air arts group that was founded in 1985 by Ray Strong and Arturo Teo. And Jeremy is going to be all over Santa Barbara this week if you haven't seen him already, because his painting is being used as the official poster of Old Spanish Days, aka Fiesta. When his poster was unveiled back in May at a fundraiser I was covering, I got to meet Jeremy for the first time. He's a very cool, very unassuming guy. And soon I was thinking, I gotta get this guy on the show. And so after some back and forths, he invited me to his Montecito studio, and we had this great chat, which you're just about to hear. For Santa Barbara folks hearing this, you all know about Fiesta, and you probably have an opinion on it. But for our out-of-town listeners, which I'm happy to say is a whole lot of you, Fiesta, a.k.a. Old Spanish Days, is Santa Barbara's five-day-long festival where the town celebrates its mixed heritage, Spanish, California, Mexican, Chumash, and white Europeans. Don't forget them. All that history, all wrapped together. It's based on a very romanticized historical event, I'm sure. A big old wedding party that happened back in the days before California was in the Union. But since 1924, it's been official Santa Barbara Festival. It's been a chance to dress up like señores and señoritas and watch horse parades and flamenco dancing and eat Mexican food and drink tequila, as if you really needed a reason to do that. But now it's a sanctioned, I believe. Also, eggs filled with confetti, and you smack them on other people's heads. That's a thing that we do here. So watch out, but only during Fiesta. Now, look, I mean, some people can't stand Fiesta, locals, you know, some locals, because of the chaos and the crowds that descend on the city, just as I assume some people in New Orleans are like, oh, Mardi Gras, go away, frat boys, go away. But to so many in Santa Barbara, it's a big deal, a very big deal. Now, several generations of Santa Barbara's, it's a big deal. I've been writing on it for years. I've been asked to by the paper to write on it, and I have done. And over that time, I've come to not exactly jump in the fray dressed as a Spaniard. I'm not going to go that crazy, but I certainly do respect Fiesta and what it means to people. That's what happens when you write about things, when you're asked to write about things outside your zone, basically. Also, I have a very dear memory of my first Fiesta, which, believe it or not, was when I was 15, not when I was a child. I guess I just didn't get out a lot when I was younger. But anyway, I remember at this one point, talking about my parents, this was when I was on a holiday. I was visiting my mom, who was still living here, and walked down to the Mercado. That's one of the open-air markets, a half block of Santa Barbara, which they turn over and set up stalls and food stalls. And I remember it's been a very hot August night, walking down there in t-shirt and shorts, probably corduroy shorts, knowing me in 1985 when that happened. And I remember having a blast. I was like, what is this deal? How long has this been going on? I said to myself. And many types of Mexican food as I could, because at that time I was living in England, and I really didn't, you couldn't get Mexican food at all. You still can't really, but more than you used to in 85, that was a big problem. And I couldn't believe it. It was a kid in the candy store, as they say. And one of the things I remember, those neon bracelets. I think maybe I'd never seen one before. Neon bracelets. I went crazy for neon bracelets. I wrapped them around my head and my neck and my wrists and my legs. And I'm pretty sure I probably had a beer sometime that evening. And I was in love with everybody. Well, maybe not everybody, but many cute girls walking around during Fiesta, of my age, of course, and celebrating that. Celebrating being a teenager and looking forlornly at girls who I could not possibly talk to in any way whatsoever. But, you know, cherished memory, dance the night away, and realize, oh yeah, I'm a teenager, I can do these things. And it was a little bit of a permission to be an adult in Santa Barbara. So that's my memory of a fiesta, basically going down and having some taquitos and making a fool of myself. Okay. All right. Talk about making a fool of myself. I have a major announcement. Other news here. Major announcement. Mark your calendars, folks. Friday, November 18th, 2016. Yes, this year. Because we are going to have our 100th Funk Zone podcast episode live. Oh my goodness, live at SB Cast. You've heard me talk about SB Cast a few times down on Garden Street, and now we're going to have our event there. You, of course, wherever you are, you're invited. Right now, details are still being worked out about who's going to be there, but look forward to a version of the show, but with several guests, a shorter, musical interludes, some video, silent auction, and more things. I'm trying to cook it up to make it a very interesting and fun event. It will also be a ticketed event, of course. Well, I say of course, but really it has to be a ticketed event, but it will be very affordable. I'm very, very excited about this event. I hope you can hear it in my voice. I wanted to go out big on the 100th episode. So we look forward to the next 100 episodes. This is a thing. So get ready. Once again, November 18th. Mark it on your calendars. All right. If you're liking the show, please consider joining our mailing list over at funksonepodcast.com. What's the benefits of being on the mailing list? You ask. Maybe out loud you ask it to nobody. Maybe you're walking with your headphones on and you just said that out loud. Well, that's good. Don't worry. You're not going insane. Here, you'll hear about new shows first. You'll hear about special deals in the store and every Friday. Oh my goodness, if you are on the mailing list, you are going to get an email that I send out personally. Curated links, 10 curated links to arts, videos, cool stuff, new artists, old artists, weird things. Yes, just 10 links is all you need. It's for your Friday afternoon when you're getting ready to leave work and your boss is not looking. In the meantime, you can also follow me on Twitter at Ted Mills. That's where I tweet. And you can like the show on Facebook at the Funk Zone Podcast page. And, of course, subscribe to us on iTunes and wherever you get podcasts. On iTunes, you can leave, and I'm saying you can, but I'm really saying please leave a review and star us, because that's what makes iTunes pay attention to this humble little podcast telling you all about Santa Barbara and the artists within it, and without it, actually. You can also show your support by pledging as little as a dollar podcast over at our page at patreon.com/funkzonepodcast. That's $1 podcast, at least $1. And if you paid the least, that's $4 a month, and that's less than a frozen pizza. There you go. Trying to save your carbs. Okay, folks, let's get this interview going with Jeremy Harper. That was recorded July 20th, 2016 at his home studio and is now presented to you on a silver platter. Here we go, and viva la fiesta, as they say. Jeremy Harper, welcome to the Funk Zone Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thank you for inviting me into the wilds of Montecito.
You're welcome.
This mystery location, which we cannot reveal, where you have your studio and your abode and everything's cool. And we are surrounded by your art, by the way. I don't know how many, what are we talking, like 50 canvases kicking around here?
Probably somewhere between 60 and 100.
60 and 100?
Yeah.
Man. And how many years worth work is that?
Well, they're rotating in and out all the time, so there are some that have been here for the entire duration of the time I've been painting, about 14 years or so. But most of them leave here within 6 months or a year, and then new ones come in. So there are a few here, though, that I am too attached to sell. So
oh, I see.
They've been here for a decade or more.
What if someone comes and says, I want that? Are you going to refuse them, or are you going to make a deal?
I'll make a deal.
Okay.
But the price has to be right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you do like a studio tour here, or is this just, do dealers ever come back here and see this?
No. If an individual calls and wants to see my studio, I will invite them in, but I don't make it public in any kind of tours or anything.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Now, the reason we're talking today is because coming up at the first week of August is, for those in Santa Barbara, everyone will know this, is Fiesta, a.k.a. Old Spanish Days. And for the first time in a long time, they have a landscape-shaped poster instead of a portrait-shaped poster, as they would say in printer terminology. And you are the artist.
That's correct.
They chose your painting as if it was a shot from the ocean, looking back towards Santa Barbara, a pre-18th century Santa Barbara, I guess we're thinking? Pre-17th century Santa Barbara?
The year precisely is, I believe it's 1791 or something like that.
Ooh.
It's when there were only two main buildings in Santa Barbara, the Mission and the Presidio Chapel.
Yeah.
Which was a quadrangle back then. It was not the way it appears today.
All broken up and...
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's this old view of what anyone coming in to Santa Barbara by ship would have seen as they neared the harbor.
Yes.
And the theme of this year's Old Spanish Days is the coastal frontier.
That's correct.
I believe. And now your work is around town, on posters, on t-shirts.
T-shirts? I didn't know that.
Probably, right? I'm just guessing there. Probably there is. How'd you feel about that?
I'm pleased. It's nice that they chose me out of so many thousands of artists here in town. So I appreciate that. Thanks to JC and the committee and his wife. I appreciate it. It's a lot of fun.
Now, did they commission you for this? How did this come about?
Well, I think he did not commission me. He asked me to do the poster. And as far as I know, JC is going to buy the painting from me. But I think the way it came about was... JC loves the ocean because he grew up surfing and I grew up surfing and, mm-hmm. and I think through Facebook, he saw my paintings and enjoyed them enough for, me to be on his so-called short list of artists he had in mind for the poster. And he came to one of my art shows and asked if, I'd be interested. And I said, yes, absolutely. So a month or two later, he called me and wanted to have breakfast and talk about it. And so we sat down with his wife and Jamie, and we talked about it. And I assumed it was going to be a Spanish dancer on the steps of the Mission.
Yeah.
And he had this ocean theme in mind, and he likes my ocean paintings, so he thought it was a good fit. And it really, I think, came about because he grew up surfing and loved the ocean, and I did too. And I think he likes the way I paint the ocean. So,
And there you had it. And then you were off to the races.
Yes,
as they said.
And I was very, very nervous about this whole project because I know people tend to be traditional in times like Fiesta and expect to see the big flowing red dress with the dramatic lighting on the Mission steps. And I assumed that no matter what I did with the ocean, people were going to give me the thumbs down, like, no, there's no dancer there. There's no horse.
Yeah.
But JC and Jamie said they don't want boats. They don't want horses. They don't want dancers. They want ocean. And he even said they want rideable surfing waves. And I thought he was kidding, but he wasn't kidding at all. And I ended up putting two point breaks in the painting because he said that. And they look like fun little waves to surf.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. For the original settlers.
Yeah.
They should have brought their boards.
Yeah, exactly.
So how'd you get that view? Did you go out and do studies? How do you?
Well,
because you don't do that, right?
I believe in as far as my artwork goes, I believe in plein air painting to make it a good painting. I feel like if I'm drawing or painting something and I have a visual reference while I'm drawing or painting the tree or a human figure, if I'm looking at something, I could do such a better job versus kind of imagining something or using photographs. So I wanted to be out on the ocean. I didn't want to be on a boat because that would be weird to keep looking down at your palette, mixing paint, and getting kind of seasick. So I went out to Ty Warner Sea Center and stood out in that vicinity of the Stearns Wharf Pier and painted a 60-inch canvas, 36 by 60 inches, looking back up towards the mission. And then I superimposed the two points after I did the planar painting of the mountains. So I spent most of the day there painting the mountains. As the day progressed, the shadows stretched out over the mountains, and I tried to capture a certain time around 5 p.m. or something like that. So there was some shadows, but putting the surfing waves and the cliffs in Ledbetter Point and Castle Rock, which no longer exists, I had to use some photos I took. I paddled a canoe out off of Ledbetter, and I had photographs, and also I had some images of old drawings that were from artists in the late 1700s that drew Castle Rock, and some old photos too. So it was a mix of a plein air painting and some photographs and some drawings from other artists that I used.
So almost like a collage.
Yes,
in a way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. For those who, even if you're from Santa Barbara, where was Castle Rock?
Castle Rock was right where the entrance to the harbor is. If you're walking into the harbor, very near the Breakwater Cafe, there's two concrete pillars. You walk right in there. Those concrete pillars were exactly where Castle Rock was, but apparently people were jumping off of it a long time ago and getting hurt, trying to jump off into the water and breaking their neck. And, they wanted to make way for more roads, really. So I think they just blew it up, bulldozed it out of the way. And that's where they put the parking lot and Cabrillo Boulevard that comes right past there. And once they built the break wall going out towards the yacht club, sand piled up, and the whole look of that whole area changed a lot.
Yeah, so much for Castle Rock.
Yeah.
That's gone.
And it was a good surf spot, too, from what I gather.
Really?
Yeah.
What year are we talking about? Were they?
You know, I don't remember what year they built the harbor. I want to say within the last 70 years. Does that seem right?
Hmm. Yes.
Yeah. I think.
Yeah.
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 But I don't know the specific date.
Oh, wow. It's always amazing to hear people were doing dumb things when they didn't have cell phones around to record them.
Yeah.
They just did it for the thrill of it.
Mm-hmm.
So no more Castle Rock, I guess.
That's right.
Would you say that this was one of the most nerve-wracking paintings you've done because you knew you had to do all these different things? And
absolutely, yes. I was so nervous about it that my back went out, and after just a day or two of this incredible tension, my muscles tightening up, I blamed the stress of the poster. So for about 2 months, I was spending money with chiropractors and various different healers massaging me and whatnot to try to alleviate the stress I was holding in my neck and shoulders and lower back. And once they did the unveiling of the Dos Pueblos Ranch and everyone applauded and loved it,
yeah,
I felt like a kid again. I felt like, oh, finally, phew. People didn't do as I thought they might do and give me the thumbs down. They all loved it.
And yeah, they loved it.
JC and Jamie were very, very good with their speeches, building it up and giving people reason to believe in it. So thanks to them. Thanks to them for that.
Mm, I'm kind of surprised that they haven't done something like that over the years. But it's surprising that they decided to break away from tradition, because sometimes I feel like an event like that, you could just go on autopilot and just say, we're just going to get the same thing over and over. But they decided to really do a different thing.
Yep.
Even, as I say, even the landscape shape of the poster.
Yes.
When's the last time they even had one that shape?
Yeah, I think there were a couple throughout the years, but not more than a couple.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, that's great, man. Like, you're everywhere now. You're gonna be, that poster's going to be everywhere in 2 weeks.
Yeah, I just went to Rose Cafe on the Mesa a few days back, and I saw it in the window there. I brought my little dog, and I sat outside with my dog and a friend and my son and his son, and we sat right beneath the poster. It was cool to see it there, and I told the waitress and the waiter guy,
yeah,
but they didn't understand when I told them that I did it. They said, "Oh, okay." They looked very confused, but finally, they figured it out, and they wanted to ask me some questions, and it was fun. It was nice.
Now you mentioned a show that JC saw the work at. When was your last show, and do you have another show coming up?
My last show, it's still up right now. It's a tribute to the Oak Group. It's a 30-year celebration of the Oak Group, and it's currently hanging in Sullivan Goss. I have one painting in there, and then Gallery 113, I have three paintings in there, and the Oak Group is showing in both of those galleries for the rest of this month. And I'm also in a Surfrider Foundation show that Escape put on, South Coast Artists Protecting the Environment, and that's at the Faulkner.
At the Faulkner, yeah.
Yeah, the Faulkner. So I've got 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 paintings downtown right now, all within a block. And the next show, I'm not really sure. It could be in Carpinteria. Yeah, two shows in Carpinteria coming up in November.
You're a busy working painter.
Well, I feel that way sometimes. Other times I don't feel that way at all. But yeah, sometimes I feel very busy.
You're actually the first guest we've had on the show from the Oak Group. I think also you're the first guest on the show that's a plein air painter. For those two who don't know about the Oak Group, and tell us a little bit about that. And for those who really don't know about plein air painting, tell us a little bit about that.
Okay. Well, the Oak Group about 30 years ago was formed by a group of friends, painting friends, Ray Strong and Arturo Teo and Michael Drury, and I could name all the names, but they just wanted to get together and paint what they loved and believed in, which was nature and wide open spaces, and bring awareness to the fact that if we don't say something and do something about it, all of our wide open spaces are going to be developed. And they've had a very big impact on the community and have raised millions of dollars to help preserve places like Hammond's Meadow and the Wilcox property or Douglas Preserve and the Carpinteria Bluffs and a number of other places. And they they're it's a very positive organization that creates beauty for future generations. You know, if we don't stand up, it's all going to be gone. All the choice, you know, pieces of land right around here.
Yeah.
And then plein air painting is a fancy French term for painting outdoors. And there's so many funny Italian or French words like beret for hat,
mm-hmm.
or plein air for painting outdoors, or a la prima is Italian for painting all in one go, which a lot of plein air painters do. They just set up and 3 or 4 or 5 hours later, they're finished with their painting.
Mm-hmm. Are you one of those?
I am one of those.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And a studio painter will have their easel set up, and for weeks they could work on a painting, and often will have a more refined look to a landscape painting, mm-hmm. because they have all the time in the world, and the light's consistent, and the shadows are not stretching and changing, and they can work from a photograph, and the more time they put into it, if they want to, they could make it look like a photograph.
Mm-hmm. But you don't give yourself that.
Well, I think that it's just my opinion, but I think that in my work, the the paintings I do from life outdoors are stronger paintings. So every once in a while, I'll do one in the studio. Someone will say, hey, can you paint my dog out in Maine on the on the steps of our house? And I'll say, sure. You're going to pay me? Yeah, I'll do it. But more often than not, I used to go more out into nature and just do anything I wanted to do. But as time goes by, there are more commissions, and sometimes you're not that excited about it, and other times you are. But it's always fun to be a little bit aimless, I think, as a painter, and drive off into the hills and not know where in the world you're going to paint, and wait until something catches your eye and jump out and paint then. But you know, today I did a commission piece in Summerlin, and I wasn't quite sure if it was going to work, because I was staring down at the freeway and telephone poles and other things that did not inspire me. But I omitted things I didn't want in there, and in the end I felt it was a successful painting. It was fun to do.
It's interesting that when you talk about plein air tradition, Oak Group particularly, that I think a lot of people see landscapes as, oh, well, this is pretty, but there's an environmental purpose behind it. Mm-hmm. You are documenting something that is vanishing or could vanish. Mm-hmm. And if you go back to several centuries ago, that was still the aim of landscape painters. Because there's a lot of landscapes that pop up during the Industrial Revolution, mm-hmm. and they're essentially doing the same thing.
Yes.
The thing is, probably behind them, while they're painting something beautiful, behind them is an awful, like a factory or something.
Yeah.
Smoke is rising from over the hills or something like that, of some coal plant or something. Yeah. And so that is it's a tradition that continues.
It is.
But we're lucky in Santa Barbara that we have a very active environmental community. I mean, the environmental movement was pretty much born here.
Yeah.
After the was it 69 oil spill? Mm-hmm. I want to get that year right. And it's continued. Did your consciousness of environmental issues happen over time, or did something happen that make you, was there an event that made you think of these things that way?
Well, I never felt like, I mean, I've always loved nature as much, if not more, than I think the average person. I've always been very in touch with it, you know, hiking and surfing and swimming and bicycling and being outdoors. I've always enjoyed it, but I never felt like someone that was compelled to be an activist in any way. I was just selected by the Oak Group to be a part of this environmental group, and it made perfect sense, because it was just came natural to want to protect the environment. I just didn't have the initiative to stand up and say, hey, let's protect this piece of land. But they had that ball rolling already, and so I just jumped aboard and have been happy to help.
And recently, the third parcel of the Carpinteria Bluffs was saved.
I heard that. Yeah, that's incredibly great news.
I mean, that's great stuff.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
I paint up there at least once or twice a year on that particular piece of land that looks down at Rincon Point. Yeah, it's a nice, really nice place, and I'm very happy that it's protected.
Yeah. Pure luck, too.
Yeah.
I mean, there was going to be some hotel there or something, and the developer, just the money backed out, all of a sudden they jumped in.
Wow.
I mean, it was luck, really. Luck and a lot of money.
Yeah.
But a lot of luck.
When did that exactly happen?
It was like last month.
Last month, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
They just need to raise a little bit more money, and it will be just owned forever.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Yeah, I was talking to Arturo really briefly about Arturo Teo, who's been spearheading that drive to save that land, and I said, congratulations, it's done. And he said, well, not quite yet. So
yes, not, it
sounds
not
like
quite.
It's close.
It's very close. Mm-hmm. I think they have maybe 80% of the money already. Okay. They just need to raise the rest of the funds, but I'm sure they will be able to do that.
Good.
Now, were you born in Santa Barbara?
I was born in Ojai.
Oh, in Ojai.
Yeah, I was born in Ojai. And I grew up most of my life here in Santa Barbara. I lived a few short years in Ventura, and when I was about four, I moved here.
And what do your parents do?
Well, my dad was a boat mechanic for his entire life down in Ventura. And my mom, they're both old enough that thinking was different back then in the 30s and 40s when they were both born.
Yeah.
So I don't know if this is true, but I heard that my mom's mom said they were farmers in Oxnard, and they said they wanted their daughters, they had four girls, they wanted their daughters to be basically, you know, I think back then not that many women were working. You know, the culture of America or the world was that a woman was to be home with the kids. And that's what my mom did. My dad was a boat mechanic. My mom stayed home with the five kids. And believe me, that's a huge job.
Wow, five kids.
Yeah, huge job.
Are you on that?
I'm the second to oldest.
You're the second oldest.
Yeah.
Any other artists among your siblings?
All of us are creative. Very really? Creative. Yeah. Either creative in the kitchen with cooking or with music or with dance or with photography or painting. We're all very creative.
Where does that come from?
I think it comes from, I think everybody in the whole world has something to offer creatively. I think it just comes from feeling supported growing up, whether it's by your parents. Our parents were both very supportive of us, whatever we wanted to do creatively, and also just your educators, your teachers at an early age, if they, you know, pat you on the back or whatever and say, yeah, you're doing great there on the piano or on the dance floor or the drawing making a painting or something. I think that encouragement is where it comes from, and it inspires kids to continue with it.
Hmm. But was there art in the house? Were there paintings in the house or things like
that? Not really. There wasn't a big push or any kind of emphasis from either parent to be creative. My mom always had music of the world playing, you know, from really obscure little pockets of the planet that had music from anywhere and everywhere. And
what was she playing on the record player?
She was playing just stuff from Africa, that from small tribes in Africa, or from she's into like kind of the rare endangered native cultures of the world and the music they played and the art they made. So she had books and music and played it often, and she didn't really take us to that many museums, but I think she was probably a little more instrumental in launching us all onto a more creative path. My dad was just too busy, you know. He was just working, trying to support a family of seven. But he also, I saw some of his drawings when he was younger, and he also, like my mom, he knew how to draw. And to this day, he's almost 82 years old, and he loves to play his organ, his keyboard, you know, his electric piano. And he doesn't draw or paint. My mom doesn't either, but they're both creative people.
Mm.
It just wasn't like, there wasn't any kind of encouragement, like, please, you guys, go be creative in the world. They just, when they saw us draw or paint or sing or whatever we did, they said, we love it. Keep doing it, you know? Mm.
Your dad was a boat mechanic, so did you spend a lot of time by the ocean?
A fair bit. He used to bring motorboats home, Sea Rays and things with big outboard engines that needed work. And at the end of a work week, he would bring them home on a Friday night. And one of his jobs was to test drive them. So he would take all of us kids out and we'd zip around in the ocean and bounce around out in the channel. And it was fun. It was a lot of fun.
So I'm curious where your love of the environment first started happening. I mean, if you're growing up in Ojai, it's pretty wild.
Yeah. Well, I didn't grow up there.
You were born there.
I was born there. I never spent more than probably 10 hours there.
Oh, okay.
at a time.
Yeah.
But,
where were you really growing up?
My parents lived in Ventura when I was born, but my mom's first child, she had my sister Jane, they wouldn't let her leave the hospital. They said, no, it's a policy. You have to stay overnight. And she said, well, I'm fine. I feel good. Why do I have to stay overnight? And they said, it's just a policy. And they wouldn't let her leave. And so she said, well, I'm not coming back here. So Ojai, she found, would let her go the same day she had the baby. Mm. You know, this was in the 60s. So
it's more progressive.
Yeah. I was born in 69 they would, I don't think in Ojai or anywhere they'd let you leave the same day now. There's so much fear of lawsuits and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But back then it was much more relaxed. But that's why they drove from Ventura up to Ojai. It's only 15 minutes or so to have me.
Hmm.
And, okay, back to your question about nature. Well,
yeah,
most of my memories, just about everything, because I was about 4 when I moved to Santa Barbara, were as a kid, just running and playing out in fields and in creeks and spending a lot of time at the beach, boogie boarding and skim boarding. And later in seventh grade, I learned how to surf. And surfing is probably the main reason why I have such a deep love for nature, is because you're sitting out there sometimes by yourself watching sunsets and dolphins and whales go by, and you just feel like you're a part of it. It's a really special thing. Surfing, unlike a lot of sports, really brings you right into nature, where not that many sports. Some sports do, like mountain snowboarding or skiing or snorkeling. You know, you're immersed in it like that. But surfing, I think, is probably the main reason why I ended up being really involved and interested in nature and loving it the way I do.
Yeah, I think it's the wading. I think that's the difference between all the other sports.
Yeah.
You know, you have time to contemplate.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, and you're really part of the ocean.
That's a good point. And it's because you do have to wait sometimes for those set waves.
And you may never get it.
You may never get them.
Yeah. You may not get anything good.
You learn patience.
Yeah.
Yeah, you do.
Where'd you go to school?
I went to... are you talking about, like, college or...
No, like just the...
I went to Montecito Union, Santa Barbara Junior High, Santa Barbara High School, Santa Barbara City College for a year and a half or two. I went to San Francisco Art Institute for 3 years. And that was it. But I also traveled a lot. I went to a lot of countries, 63 countries. And
63 countries?
63 countries, yeah.
Not on one trip, obviously.
Not one trip, okay. No. But I did 10 months in South America and hit 16 countries or something like that. And the same in Europe. South America, Central America, Mexico was one trip.
Uh-huh.
Also...
With friends?
With, mostly all my travels were alone. I went to Japan with a girlfriend, the same girl. We were in Europe on a different trip. Most of my trips were, I was alone. There were a few times where I was usually going for long periods of time. Like I'd work for a friend working construction, save $5,000 or $6,000 over a year or something, and then take off for as long as I possibly could, usually anywhere from 6 to 10 months.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I was able to just live on a shoestring, $10 a day back then in the early 90s. All through the 90s, I was traveling a lot. But you could live off of $10 a day in most of Asia and Latin America and Africa easily, as long as you were frugal, which... I am. I'm very good at conserving if I have to, saving.
When you look back on that, do you feel that that's almost a crazy thing to do, just setting out by yourself?
Well, I saved, I thought the most dangerous places I saved for last, because I wanted to get through as much of the world as I could, because I was so fascinated by it, by mainly the surf. I wanted to go to all these surf spots all over the world, and then I just fell in love with the marketplaces and the people and the languages and the music and the food.
Mm.
And everywhere was different. Everywhere was so, there was just these eye-opening experiences everywhere I went, and it was addicting. You get that travel bug and you just want to keep going.
Name a few of your favorite places. Like if you had to choose a place to go back to, like this summer, where would you go?
people ask me that a lot, and I just say I like the poor places. You know, I love Europe, I love Italy, but I think the warmth of the people in a place like Brazil or South Africa or Morocco or parts of Asia. I loved China. China was really fascinating. I was there in 93.
Oh, I was there in 95.
Were you? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's probably quite similar to when I was there. I went there
first. It was one of the last times where everything was bikes.
Yeah. I was there at that time. Did a lot of bicycling there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a really nice place. I loved it. Although it was very polluted.
Oh, it's even more polluted now, as we know.
I'm sure. But yeah, I just like poor places. I think people have a tendency to, they're not wrapped up in the rat race and competing with each other and trying to keep up with the Joneses as much. They're more just like opening up and saying, hey, come on in. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate the warmth of people in places like that, you know, South America or Central America or Mexico or Asia or Africa. I haven't spent much time in Russia, but I'm sure it's the same. I did a couple, 3 days there one time.
During the summer or during the winter?
It was the summer.
Oh, that's okay then.
Yeah, I went to the Hermitage Museum, which is one of the biggest, best museums in the world. Have you ever heard of it?
I've never been there.
Yeah. It's like the Louvre, mm-hmm. but it's in St. Petersburg, or I think it's called St. Petersburg now.
Yeah,
it was Leningrad. Yeah.
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 Yeah, they got rid of all the Stalin, the Lenins, all that kind of stuff. What was your traveling backpack kit like for these journeys?
It usually started off like a 30-pound gigantic thing that was just a pain, and within weeks it was down to 20 pounds, and I kept realizing I didn't need all this stuff. And at the end of my 10-month trip to Latin America, I had the tiniest little backpack that was made by some native people in the mountains of Peru. And it was a woven thing, and I had like a journal and one change of clothes, and I just would wash the clothes every 3 days or something. And and I had always had a surfboard. I always had a surfboard inside of a board bag, and I would stuff, you know, other things in there, a sleeping bag or, you know, a blanket or a little pillow and toiletries, toothbrush and stuff. But it was always just the bare minimum.
How much you get to travel now?
Not that much. I do a lot of little trips. Like, my son is a big inspiration. He's 9 years old, and we've taken trips to Glacier National Park. We've taken a trip to Monument Valley and Arches National Park and the Grand Canyon. And I just want to show him stuff. So we do these little week-long trips. But the type of traveling I did long ago, I'm not that interested in it anymore, because I want to be with my son and I want to be here and part of the art community.
Yeah.
And there's commissioned work and things that there's so much going on. I just feel like this is where I need to be now.
Yeah.
And I didn't exactly get it all out of my system, but I'm definitely not craving it anymore after all those years. I would like to go to 6 or 7 more countries and hit that number 70 of countries I've been to, and I probably will. But right now, as my son's just 9, he's just so fun to be around, and he'll probably be not that interested in hanging with his parents in about 4 or 5 years. And so I just want to soak it up.
But maybe at some point he's going to do his own solo tour.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I think that's the best education on earth, is to travel. Much better than any university or school.
Where along the lines, go back to your schooling, did art come into it?
I would say before I even got into kindergarten, I wanted to be an artist, and I always put a lot of energy into it. You know, I was always drawing and painting, and anytime we got a wad of clay in third grade or whatever, I loved it. I that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to make things and draw and paint, and I took it seriously from the age 4 or 5. I don't know. It's just something I've always loved and always wanted to do. But after high school, most of the classes I took at Santa Barbara City College were figure drawing and art history. I took some English and some geology and some regular history courses. But I wanted to transfer to an art school, so I got enough credit to transfer up to San Francisco Art Institute and just did my final 3 years there. The desire to study art and to be an artist happened long, long ago, like 1974.
But say in college, were you doing work like this?
No, not at all.
Who were you influenced by at that time?
I had a pretty open mind. I think most kids do when they're 18 through 27. They're just kind of figuring things out. And I was open to all types of art, from sculpture to painting, abstract painting, figurative stuff to you know, back then I remember there were some artists that were really well known and they were doing performance pieces and there was installation art. And I didn't quite get that so much, you know, people hurting themselves. There was I think his name was Jesse Burden, Jesse Burden. But he like put himself up on a cross and had someone shoot him. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you're
something
talking about.
Something Burden, right? But
which is sad because I've written an article about it.
Yeah, and I'm like, this is art? So this guy, his friend shoots him in the shoulder and this is art?
Yeah.
Or I think one time he had someone run him over in a Volkswagen.
He got crucified to a Volkswagen.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
That's a long time ago. Yeah. I can't remember. So the teachers up there, they wanted us to do something that had never been done. I remember the first day I got an assignment. I was given a journal and I was told to go out into the world and come up with something. And at the end of the weekend, come back on Monday and show the teacher what you had. Mm. And I hiked up Mount Tamalpais, and from San Francisco, I drove over the bridge and I hiked up Mount Tamalpais and I made a sketch of the mountain reflecting into a big puddle. It had rained the night before and it was this huge puddle, and I did this reflecting drawing and I thought it was pretty good. And the teacher opened up my book and looked at it and rolled his eyes, went, pfft. He's all, "You're in the wrong department." And I'm like, what do you mean? He's all, photography's upstairs. And I'm like, well, what's that supposed to mean? He's all, "Well, I'll tell you what it means. A camera does a lot better job than you do at depicting a mountain." And I was like, oh, okay. Well, so what am I supposed to do? And he said, "Give me something original." He said, "Representational art's been done over and over again." He's all, "Haven't we seen enough of that shit?" And he was just like pissed off. And a lot of the instructors were like that up there. They wanted you to pull something out of yourself that had never been seen.
Yeah.
So almost everybody was doing weird abstract stuff, and it was fun, and I have no regrets. I enjoyed every little bit of that school. It was a great experience.
You got into that after a while?
I did a lot of figurative stuff, and I ended up making the figure more abstract, and it was fun. I had a good time. It was a great I think when you're in your early 20s, that's the time to do that, you know, to really push your creative mind. But coming back here doing landscapes is a better fit, because I've always loved drawing from life. I've always loved drawing and painting from life, whether it's a still life or something, a beach scene or a mountain scene. Mm. It's just, it's kind of like piecing together a puzzle, you know, and you, at the end, you feel rewarded. You did it. You're like, wow, I actually captured that. Mm. And there's a great sense of satisfaction for me drawing and painting from life. When I draw and paint from life, I love it.
Mm. Was that after the travels? After you did all the traveling?
It was after the travels. Yeah. I came back here to Santa Barbara and I thought, okay, well, I'm an artist. I've always wanted to do it. I'm going to end up doing abstract art because that's what I'm supposed to do.
What year was that?
That was probably mid to late 90s, like 96, something like that. 96, 97. And a nice guy here in town is still my friend, Rick Stitch, had a shot center class. It was abstract painting. And I thought, well, I'll jump in that and see if he could show me something new. And he's the one that introduced me to Ray Strong. And it was right around the time I started landscape painting, because some friends of mine wanted landscape paintings. And they said, "Jeremy, can you do some landscape paintings for me?" And I said, "That's not really what I do." But they said, "Well, we'll pay you, you know." And I said, "Well, okay." So I went and did these paintings, and ended up loving them. And Rick Stitch saw them and wanted me to talk to Ray Strong, and Ray liked them and wanted me to come back. He said, come back in 3 to 6 months with 6 more paintings. And I did that about 6 times with him. And at that time, he was probably in his mid-90s, and he was getting really old, and he ended up moving up to Three Rivers. I think he had a sister up there he was staying with, but that was a really great opportunity to get to spend some one-on-one time with Ray Strong and hear his ideas and his words about landscape painting.
Yeah, Ray Strong is a character.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or he was a character.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you got a good story about Ray Strong? Because he was very flirty with the ladies, too.
He was. I mean, I think one of the best things was his booming voice and his enthusiasm for life. He would talk about his wife, Betty, and these big bellows would be like, oh, and he'd talk about nature that way too, like, look at those curves, and it was just so loud, you know, and, so positive, positive force, like he was projecting, he was putting so much positive feeling out into the world with his energy. It was really a great thing to be able to meet him.
He saw the earth as the woman, as the earth mother, didn't he?
Yep, that's right.
Yeah. Look at those curves. He's talking about some hills and some mountains.
Exactly.
It's good that you got to meet him, and
it was good. I want to thank Rick Stitch for thinking of introducing me to him.
Yeah,
it was awesome. I remember the very first time I met him, he was so old, I thought, who lives into their 90s? You know, this could be, he might die next week. I thought, I have to really thank him for this experience, because this was just profound. Mm. And I patted him on the back and got down real close to his face, and I said, thank you for your enormous spirit. Mm-hmm. And he didn't hear me. He said, huh? And I said, thank you very much for your enormous spirit.
Yeah.
And he looked at me and kind of smirked and said, okay, you know, but I got to see him about 5 times after that. So yeah, it was great.
It seems those two guys are very responsible for you getting into what you're doing now.
Well, Ray had nothing to do with it. I mean, it was really just a collective decision. The Oak Group, they have these meetings. I go to them now and we talk about all kinds of stuff. So I think they had, you know, a list of names, and they all looked at the websites of these different various artists and decided that they would ask me. So I was pretty thrilled, because I overheard Marcia Burt say one time at the Faulkner Gallery that the group's closed. Mm. And because someone said, how do I get into the Oak Group? And she said, it's closed. It's a closed group. And so I thought, well, I don't have to want to get into that. That's easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when I got a call from Arturo, I was like, what? Sure. Gosh, I'd love to.
Why'd they let you in?
Well, I think they, yeah, I don't know. At the time, there's a lot more plein air painters now in Santa Barbara than there was then. It was about 7 or 8 years ago. I think it was 7 years ago. And it seems like there's 4 times as many plein air painters now. But at that time, there weren't that many here. Mm-hmm. Not that I was seeing. Mm-hmm. And I was having fun doing little shows around town, from Summerlin to Carpinteria to the Faulkner, and they had seen me. So I think that's how it happened. I was making my work visible. That's how it happened. Mm.
So it was closed, but open.
It was closed, but they wanted to keep a certain number. Like, I think it was 25 or 26. They wanted to try to keep that number strong of members. And unfortunately, some people had gotten older and passed away, and they thought, well, a lot of us are getting older, and we got to invite some new members in here. Mm-hmm. And keep this group alive. It's such a good cause to have the presence of the Oak Group in Santa Barbara, helping bring awareness to wide open spaces and try to slow down the development a little bit. It seems inevitable, but we could save a few more big chunks of land.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
After you, though, has there been new members into the Oak Group?
No.
So it's a closed group.
Yeah, but
it's a closed group.
But things change all the time, you know. There will be new members.
I want to ask about the method of playing Air Force and your method. You give yourself a set amount of time, and I'm assuming, how do you cope with the mutability of everything? Everything's changing while you're painting it. How do you deal with that in your mind?
I think, like, you get in kind of a mental a state of mind where you're not really thinking about any of these challenges. You're working as quickly as you can to get the paint down and to get it to get it on the canvas, because you know you don't have much time. But I get into kind of like a zone, you know, where I'm not really thinking about pressure. I'm just painting. And the sun moves pretty slow, so you have time. You know, you've got time. It's not really, unless you're painting a sunset and you've got 20 minutes, then you're really kind of stressing. But most of the time, you've got, you know, a good 5-6 hours ahead of you to get this painting down, and it's not really an issue. I think I did a lot of figure drawing, and most figure drawing classes, you start out with about a 30 or 40 second pose. You move up to a minute, minute and a half pose. Then you do about a 3 or 5 minute pose. And then by the time you're at, for me, by the time I was at the 15 or 20 minute pose, I felt like, what are we doing? Still looking at this pose. This is 20 minutes. This is way too long. Like, all we need is 5 minute poses, because you're getting so warmed up on the, on the short poses, that the 1 minute long poses, that by the time you're doing the 20 or 30 minute pose, I wanted them to change. I was like, done, got it. So I learned how to work quick through figure drawing, and I think that really helped me with plein air painting, as I could take a bigger canvas because of all the time I spent figure drawing and lay it down pretty quick. And then, you know, later as the days progress, you can take that 90% finished painting into your studio and just do the last little bit there.
Mm-hmm. Is it acrylic?
It's oil.
It's oil.
Yeah.
What are the properties of oil? Why do you choose oil over acrylic?
I'm not a technical person like that. And I was just given, I was in a class at the Shot Center that Michael Drury taught. And it was about my second year, maybe, painting landscape paintings. And he said that one of his students decided that the class wasn't for her. And he gave me a box of all of her stuff, all of her paints, her turpentine and linseed oil, and he said, give it a try. And I thought, well, I don't know, this acrylic is so simple, you just add water and, you know, it's so easy to clean up. And I felt a little bit nervous about it, but he said, it's easy, don't worry about it, just do it, just jump in and do it. And I looked at it and I'm like, okay, I will. And from that point on, I switched from acrylic to oil because Michael told me to. And I really trusted him, everything he said, and I still do. He's a great teacher.
What's your routine? What do you try to get in every day?
I would like to paint every day. It doesn't happen every day. I ended up looking at waves and driving to Ventura, chasing a south swell in the flat summer. But I'm trying right now to do 25 days in a row painting. And sometimes if I don't paint one day, I have a lazy Sunday, I'll try to do two on Monday. But it takes quite a bit of energy when you do a bigger one. Like today, I did a bigger one, and it really drains you. You're the whole time you're focusing so hard, and the sun's moving slow, but it's moving, and the shadows are changing right before your eyes, and you feel a little bit worn out sometimes, a little mentally frazzled at the end of a 5 hour session or something.
Mm. How do you recharge?
Relax, have a good sleep, a good dinner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. How often do you get to go out on the board?
Surfing?
Yeah.
Oh, I go all the time. Anytime there's waves, I go. The thing is, there's not waves very often. We live in such a sheltered south-facing coast, with the Channel Islands protecting us from most of the southern energy. Mm-hmm. And because Point Conception up there is west facing, it takes a big swell to wrap around the corner and get into our channel. So I go hunting for waves about 2 or 3 days a week tops. But if there was good surf here every day, like right out here in Santa Barbara, I would go surfing every day.
Mm.
Well, much like some people go to the gym every day or go for a bike ride or a run or a walk around the block. That's just something I love doing.
What's more likely, surfing, but then you're thinking about painting, or painting and you're thinking about surfing?
It's more likely that I'd be painting thinking about surfing, because I often will set my canvas, my easel up like right at a surf spot.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, okay, it's been flat as a lake for 11 days. And now out of nowhere, I'm in the middle of a painting and there's a chest high swell coming in and nobody's down here. I'm like, this sucks. I've got to go home and get my board. So the surfing, because you can't really do it every day.
Yeah.
I have to make that more important when the waves are good. It's like, okay, now the waves are good, I've got to surf.
All right. Well, you try to split up your week pretty much. Painting and surfing.
Yes.
Sounds like the life, man.
Yeah, it's fun. It's good for sure.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying it.
All right. Well, thanks for talking to me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, Jeremy, for having me in your home and sharing your thoughts. And for people who are out and during Fiesta, when you see that painting, that's Jeremy. Pick up a poster.
Thanks for the interview. I appreciate it, Ted.
All righty.
All right.
Cheers.
Cheers.
There you have it, folks. Jeremy Harper in conversation with me at his home in Montecito. I think that chat went very well, and I've ran into Jeremy a few times since, and we have lots of pleasant chats, just like the one you heard. Good times. You can get his poster over at the Old Spanish Days website if you're not in Santa Barbara and want to have a look at it. That's www.sbfiesta.org. And by the way, I was lax in the beginning to tell you Jeremy Harper's site. I got so excited about Fiesta for some reason telling you that. So Jeremy Harper, you can find him at jeremyharper.com, but that is jeremy-harper.com. I guess jeremyharper.com was taken. So jeremy-harper.com, and you can see many, many more examples of his lovely plein air paintings. I intend to have a few more plein air painters on the show in upcoming episodes, because they are an important part of Santa Barbara art and art history, and so look forward to that. More details as they come. Now, of course, just what I said earlier in the show, consider going over to funkzonepodcast.com, signing up for our mailing list. Also, you can find me on Facebook at Funk Zone Podcast. Like that. Please like us. And also Twitter. I'm there as Ted Mills, tweeting away. And you can always add us to iTunes as well, if you haven't already. Okay, that's great. If you are coming from a Fiesta link and you've never heard the show before, but you're from Santa Barbara and wanted to know more, thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for making it all the way through to the end. I hope you like it, and I hope you subscribe to the other podcast episodes. Also, you can drop us a line at Funk Zone Podcast. Go over there and just drop us a comment. Let us know what you think about the show. Okay, that's it for me this week. I guess I'm just about to head out to one of the Mercados, get some food, and watch some dancing, and have a tequila. Not that, everything in moderation. Whew! We'll be back next week. We will be back next week with another artist in interview. Can't tell you who it is yet. You guess you'll have to find out. Until then, I'm going to leave you with the wise, sage words of my second grade friend, Joseph. Take it away, Joe. I'll see you later, folks. Bye.
And now for a big goodbye. See you soon. We'll make some more tapes later on. Bye. We might make some more tapes later on. Bye. We might make more tapes later on. Yeah. See you soon. Bye.